We've taken a fair amount of time in the 13th chapter of Corinthians, but that is a wonderful chapter, and certainly it's a careful definition of Christian love. If you want to know what Christian love, and some would call it agapao, would mean, you can't go wrong by looking there. But it's useful, useful to Corinthians, useful to this day. And in many ways, Christian love is the antidote to selfishness. And selfishness is at the core of human nature. I want something for me. And that is what it's like, really, to be human. I'm interested, you know, or you might say, well, what's in it for me? Selfishness was the root of the problems in the Corinthian church. You had gifts, and so one person was envying another person's gift or envying the attention somebody else got. Selfishness was marring the celebration of the Lord's table. Look at all this stuff I got that I brought. I'm going to stuff myself. As for you, you got nothing. Yeah, suck it up. Go hungry. That is not Christian love. Paul strongly criticized it, but at the end of chapter 12, as he finishes instruction, he said, I'm going to show you a more excellent way. Chapter 13, in a capsule, is the more excellent way. Because love should distinguish the church from other organizations. Okay? So the church is not the Moose Club. The church is not the Odd Fellows. The church is not the Masonic Lodge. The church is or should be something different. And so, at the beginning of chapter 14, I'm going to read these three verses now. Paul says, pursue love, yet desire earnestly spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. For one who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men but to God, for no one understands, but in his spirit he speaks mysteries. But one who prophesies speaks to men for edification, exhortation, and consolation. And so, Paul says, pursue. Looking back in the original language, one of the meanings of this Greek word translated as pursue is to hunt or chase after with intensity. Now that I understand. If you go out to hunt, you can't be careless. You can't be sloppy with your equipment or your time. You can't be shiftless. About the time you speed up your pace and start to make a little noise, you bust out a deer out in front of you and you don't get a chance. You have to concentrate. And so you chase with intensity. That means you're out early. It means you're out late. It means your wife is a widow during this period of time. You make an investment in time. Also, you make an investment in equipment. You're out in the cold. You're out in the snow. You might be out in the rain. I don't care for that. And you show intense exertion. It's work. Once your quarry, whatever it is in hand, then the work is just started. Because whatever you get has got to be dressed, got to be transported, it got to be made table ready. Okay, and so it's time and it's effort. And believe me, over the years, I've seen sloppy hunters, casual hunters, and expert hunters. And the difference is dramatic. Because The sloppy or lazy hunter, he depends on luck that he'll stumble over something. And DEC figures show that Mr. Average gets a deer about once every 7 years. Now, I've gotten quite a few years worth if you go that once every 7 years, but there's a difference. There's a difference. And I use this example because Christian love is the same. Same thing, needing effort. He uses this phrase because if you pursue love, it doesn't really happen by chance. It does not happen casually. The lazy person finds it nearly impossible to pursue love. It's a deliberate choice. And so, anything of any importance you accomplish in life takes some work. I had an old friend of mine who was a pastor down in West Virginia talk to me, and he said, "Ward, I really want some helmet stands." He has a collection of memorabilia, like from the First World War and so forth. And so he needs a stand, like a 9-inch tall stand or 10-inch or whatever, to put the helmets on. But he said they cost so much money, I can't afford to buy them. I said, "All right, I'll make you some. Send me a picture and some dimensions of one you like." And so, over the next few weeks, I made up, I think, 6 of them for him. And we drove halfway down to West Virginia, and he drove halfway up. And we met in the parking lot of a shopping mall and exchanged them. But it's not something, because he and I are old, old friends, it's not something that was done overnight, not something done casually. Selecting wood, turning the wood, staining the wood, varnishing the wood, polishing and so forth, it took time and it took work. And to make a simple example, if someone's sick and you want to take them some chicken soup, first you got to go out and get the chicken. Okay, you're going to cook it, you're going to make broth, maybe you're going to get some rice and lentils or some potatoes and carrots, whatever it is you're going to put in the soup. You're going to heat it up. You're going to take it to them, you know, when it's pretty fresh out of the pan. You can't just click your fingers. Okay. And I don't think it would be enjoyed as much as if you bought a can of soup and took it to them. Say, "Hey, just open this and heat it up. You're good to go." You're pursuing that. You're chasing after it. And so the Christian love is a choice. It's something that we decide to do, and then we take steps to do it. And we're using the same care and diligence of the person that's out, whether chasing a deer or grouse or whatever it is. We're hunting it. We're after it. And so with this command, he says, chase it. What are you going to chase? You're going to chase what I just explained to you in chapter 13. You don't need to know any more because it's very carefully laid out. And so he says, pursue love, but earnestly desire spiritual gifts, and especially that you may prophesy. Now, I've had people that have argued with me, all the church needs to do is love. Love everybody. Anyone that thinks that's all you need to do ought to stop and read this verse where it says chase it. Because love can be the why behind some of the things we do. But it's not the what. And it's not the how. you know, if someone comes to you with a problem, and the response might possibly be, well, I'll pray for you. Now, the people I mentioned this morning, I like to go in the hospital and pray with Steve Andrinoff, but I won't be able to get by Checkpoint Charlie at the door. They won't let me in. And so I'm very limited in what I can do. In some cases, prayer is the only thing we can do. But in other cases, it's not. James tells us you can speak pleasantly to a hungry or naked person. Oh, depart in peace. Be ye warmed and filled. Hey, I'm going to pray for you. I got good feelings for you. I love you. It's of little value if we don't give them what they need. So he reminds us that love is not just necessarily nice thoughts or pleasant speech, okay? Or, you know, something where you say, oh, we love you, or the church loves you. Love is today. Love is action. Okay? We look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. Here's some fellow laying beside the road, all beat up, and he stopped, and he picked him up, and he said, boy, this guy's in rough shape. And he tore up some clothes, and he put oil and wine on the wound. He bandaged him up, stuck him on his donkey, hauled him down to the inn, put him in bed, said to the innkeeper, here's a couple denarius. He said, take care of this guy till he can get up and around. Listen, if you spend more when I come back, I'll pay you up. You won't lose money. It's action, okay? And in the case of our person who is cold or hungry, if they need a coat, doesn't do any good to say, well, I'll pray for you to get a coat, you know? We give them a coat. We tell them, here, you keep this. The love might be the why, but the what and the how is a coat that comes out of the closet. And our person without the coat walks away warm when he previously was cold. On the other hand, if the person goes away cold because he still doesn't have a coat, then love has failed. Love has failed. I was down by an interchange one time, and we were out on some kind of a family event, had all kind of food with us. I had a person with a big sign, says, we'll work for food, you know. So I stopped the car, said, hey, come over here, you know, and I opened up the cooler, started handing out food to him. About as much as his hands could carry. I said, you don't have to do any work. Here's something so you can eat. Now, sometimes some of these guys are scammers that stand with a sign. I know that. You know that. But why should he be hungry when I had a cooler full of food sitting in the trunk? I could spare it. A lot of times they say, Pastor Heyman used to tell me, if they call and say I'm hungry, I don't give them money. I take them and I get them something to eat, and I see them eat it. I know where the money went then. That's what you call prudent and sensible Christian love. Of course, Heyman was a smart guy. So, pursue love means chase it, desire it, exercise it. Do your best to make it what? A lifestyle, the way you do things. But earnestly desire spiritual gifts as well. Now, the Corinthians, we know, were interested in tongues. That brought attention to the speaker. And notice Paul says desire spiritual gifts. He doesn't say desire to speak in tongues. He said desire to prophesy. he will develop that theme throughout this chapter. He's talking about edification. Now, we should define our terms back to the first century. The verb tense for prophesy indicates a plural understanding. This is important. Not so much that one individual should desire to prophesy, because the issue with the tongues was the emphasis on the person. Me, listen to me. I'm babbling this stuff. Everyone pay attention. No. Rather, that the church as a whole, the whole group, should desire to prophesy, either themselves or to hear it. Because it's for the collective benefit of the church. So not everybody's going to be able to do it, but there's a desire. And so here again, Paul is trying to turn the spotlight, the emphasis, away from the individual and toward the group. It's important because the needs and the good of the congregation as a whole is where he's going. Today we often think of the word prophesy to predict future events, but if you look to verse 3, you can see that that's not what Paul had in mind. He's talking such things as consolation, okay? He's talking exhortation, edification. That's a term borrowed from the trades, building up. Now, we know that what we call today ecstatic speech, for you Greek scholars, glossolalia. I put that in for Mark. He likes that. Was used in some of the pagan temples, okay? And it was often accompanied by alcoholic drink and dancing to exhaustion. And this speech didn't have any intelligible meaning. It wasn't meant to have any. People could be exhausted from dancing. They could be intoxicated from alcohol. And participants would work themselves into some kind of a frenzy and then babble some kind of speech. And it was believed that reaching semi-consciousness or unconscious state would let their spirits commune with the gods. The term that Paul uses in chapter 14 is the same word that was also used at the time to describe this pagan speech. And you see it in various Eastern religions today. In other words, you chant or you concentrate until you go out of yourself, okay? Go somewhere else, if you will. It's important to understand, as Paul talks about various things, he does not want the practices of those pagan temples to come into the church. Some of these things were seen as, quote, very religious. What do you do things by? What do you judge things by? Your culture. What you learned at your mother's knee. Okay. So in some cultures, this over here is edible. In other cultures, it's disgusting. Okay? In some cultures, this mode of dress is perfectly acceptable. In other cultures, totally unacceptable. So if the office girl in her miniskirt and high heels were to be transported into Mecca in Saudi Arabia, the religious police would whisk her off the street or be dressed in a shameful manner. Not acceptable in that culture. So in the Corinthian cultures, some things were seen as very religious. Remember the temple priestesses that had their heads uncovered when they ministered? Seen as very religious. And so some of the women were trying to do it in the church, and Paul says, don't do it. Remember the pagan priests that always had a hood or some kind of hat on their head in the pagan temple, or on the coin, the picture of Caesar with a hood on, which some of those remain to this day, and seen as very religious. Paul says, don't do it. Don't do it. I don't want that in the church. And so it's very important that Paul didn't want these things borrowed. And it appears as though some of this ecstatic babbling, glossolalia, if you will, was being borrowed from the pagan religion. And I've said this before, I'm going to repeat it again, and I probably will repeat it again. Our Baptist services and churches tend to be kind of plain Jane. You don't see any headdress on my head. Okay. I'm not burning incense. I'm not burning chicken feathers. Okay. I'm not borrowing stuff from other religions that might be perceived as religious. It's not by accident. The richness that we want is not in robes, not in headdresses, incense, gold or silver. The richness that we are pursuing is spiritual in nature, okay? The riches of God through Jesus Christ. That's where we're going. That's what we are pursuing. Verse 2 compares gifts. Paul says that the person speaking in tongues speaks to God and not men. Nobody understands. Certainly God understands the heart of all men. If you speak, if you teach, if you pray, God knows what's in your heart. Whether it's honest, whether it's earnest, he knows. Okay. Remember Matthew chapter 6 and verse 7. Jesus is teaching the disciples to pray. He says, don't use meaningless repetition as the heathen do. They think they're going to be heard for their many words. And so if you pray the same identical prayer over and over and over again 20 or 30 times, he says, don't think you're going to be heard for your much speaking. The Lord's Prayer is clear. It's succinct. It's not overly long and very easily understood. But when we read that if you speak in tongues, nobody understands, this reminds us more of the speech in the pagan temples. But on the contrary, when the disciples, when the apostles spoke at Pentecost, they said, wait a minute, this guy from Galilee in the backwaters of Israel is speaking in my language. How is this possible? And so people from abroad and the Jewish dispersion could easily understand what was being said. And this leads me to believe that at least some of the Corinthians could have been faking, speaking in tongues, simply babbling to get attention. Aside from selfishness, another big facet of human nature is a desire to be noticed. Ever hear the little kids say, Mom, Mom, look at me, see what I can do? Starts early and it never ends. Center of attention, that's where people like to be. And so here you can see people sometimes doing things that they don't have the skill and ability to do. I had a gentleman one time that approached me to teach Sunday school, and I knew the man. In fact, my father knew him from old times. And he was a sincere enough fellow, but he was no teacher. He didn't have the knowledge, he didn't have the education. But I told him I'd let him try. But our pastor, when he heard about it, got to panicking. And he said, I want to teach the class. I teach the class. And so the man came to me complaining, saying, you know, why did you change it? And I said, well, I can't tell the pastor he can't teach. Now, would it have been a disaster? Most likely, yes. Would I, after one lesson, have had to tell the guy, I'm sorry, but you just don't have what it takes to be a teacher? Probably. I wasn't afraid of that conversation, though, and I was going to go down that road rather than tell him that, in my judgment, he was not able. But some people can't, all right? And it shouldn't shock us that down through history, some people have tried to do things in the church they really didn't have the ability to do. But in this letter, Paul pointed out previously, everybody can do something. And what you do is important to the body as a whole. Every little ministry is needed. And so, you know, you can't say the nose is a minor part of my body, so we just cut that off and forget about it. No, it's needed. It's small, but it's needed. Various commentaries, by the way, have taken different positions on tongues, and I've read some in one camp and some in the other. Some claim that tongues were ecstatic speech with essentially no meaning. Others say they're always some kind of language, and the speaker, of course, always knew what he was saying. Now, I've read these, but I've not been able to agree completely with either one. Both are interesting positions, and the men have many arguments to bolster that. But we have the text in Acts where the apostles are speaking, and it was known languages. It wasn't ecstatic speech. It was understood by the hearers. But yet we have this text where Paul says nobody can understand. And so it's hard to be dogmatic. If there was no interpreter, someone speaking in a tongue was supposed to keep silent. Now, if there's no interpreter, which means a person can't speak, it's clear from the text the speaker didn't know what he was saying. Otherwise, what? He would have interpreted. And it is a debated issue to this day. But what's clear from the text is there were problems in the usage of this gift that Paul was trying to address for the good of the church as a whole. Now, he didn't say in the text that he thought some people were fakers. You know, and when people came into my office and told me some big story, I didn't necessarily tell them they were liars. I just made some conditions and did some things to build some fences around the lies, if you will. If you look at what Paul wrote, that's exactly what he was doing. He wasn't accusing anybody of being a faker, but he built some fences to keep the fakers out, essentially. Now, a note on our text. In verses 2 and 4, the word tongue is singular. But in contrast, in verse 5, the word is tongues in the plural. It's possible that the apostle uses the singular tense to indicate fakers and the plural to point out the real gift. The King James translation inserts the word unknown into the text before this singular word tongue, which the translators were there trying to point up the difference between singular and plural. Unknown doesn't appear in the original Greek text, but that's something of a commentary insertion to help the reader. Some commentators maintain it's simply a language not understood in the church, but if nobody understands it, seems to me that would include the speaker as well. If the speaker doesn't understand what he's saying, it becomes impossible to interpret what's been said. One explanation for that is that gibberish or nonsense is singular. You're talking nonsense. No one ever says you're talking nonsensus. On the other hand, tongues or languages would properly be plural, as there are many. And so in verse 3, Paul says that whoever prophesies speaks to men for edification, exhortation, and consolation. We're going to look at these three terms. Edification, as I said before, is borrowed from the construction trade. It's a building. Simple meaning is building up, laying block, nailing 2x4s. Paul spoke in chapter 3 of himself as a wise master builder, laying a foundation in Jesus Christ. And he said, anyone that builds on this foundation better be careful how they build. Building up is what the church does. Sometimes we build buildings. Sometimes we add numbers, build up the congregation. Sometimes we work in the local community, build up the testimony of the church. We always seek to enhance the Christian life, build up our members, the walk of our members as they become more mature. These things are all edification. We're building. Exhortation. They exhort us to encourage. The church passed through hard times in the first century. Persecution from the Jewish community, from the Romans, and from others. Now, this past year has been hard for churches. Churches have been closed. Some churches are still closed. We were closed for a period of time. I have seen predictions that some churches or many churches will never be the same. My desire is to see this church come back stronger than ever. That's where I am. That's what I want. Many have turned to electronic media to send out messages, and of course, we send out messages via email. We put messages on the website. We have CDs made that we can send out upon request. We send out sermon notes via snail mail to those that are technologically behind the times. And so we do what we can to try what? To be all things to all men, you know, so we can do something for at least some of them. The government has put restrictions on the church, and there's been open conflict between biblical commands to obey authority and biblical commands to not forsake the gathering of ourselves together, as the manner of some is. And so exhortation is needed. The members are encouraged to persevere. Keep on keeping on. Keep on going. And so, as I say, let us pray that our churches will come out the other side of this pandemic stronger than ever. Purified, if you will. Consolation. During tough times, people need consolation. They can be widespread, such as our pandemic, or can be personal, as people might have to face troubles or loss in their own lives. One of the purposes to prophesy is to console people who are in need. An example that comes to mind is the funeral service. When they did the memorial service for the Hallidays, I was up here and I was remembering various things when I had known them when they were in better health or when I visited later in the nursing home and so forth. And some things brought at least a smile to the gathered friends and relatives. And where we are going there is consolation. Consolation in the course of bereavement. And so you honor the memory of the one who is gone before us, and also you seek consolation for those who remain. Funerals are tough. I have not found them to get easier, even after doing some. But yet, the consolation there is a duty that must be undertaken. And so you can say that the church doesn't speak in tongues, and we don't need to study this, but speaking in tongues has been revived. It's out there. And it's very possible that any one of you might meet someone who participates in that on a regular basis. And so there is teaching out there that speaking in tongues is a sign of salvation. You can't be saved unless you do it. But remember chapter 12 and verse 30, where Paul says, all do not speak in tongues. And so if all did not speak of tongues all these many, many, many years ago, then it would be a perversion to say all must speak in tongues today. But you might run into this doctrine. And brethren, I would not have you ignorant. And it's helpful to know and understand the safeguards that Paul put in place in the church, which, as a matter of fact, are not always followed in the charismatic groups. And in this chapter, we're going to delve into this a little more. And the whole chapter that Paul is writing here is really a call for clarity, okay? Edify the church, be clear in the church, make people know what you're saying. Our God is not the author of confusion. If you read the Gospels where Jesus is teaching, what he's teaching is pretty plain. It's pretty clear. Now, sometimes when the masses didn't want to listen, he spoke in parables and then explained the parables to his disciples afterwards. And the idea there was, to the people that really didn't want to listen, he couldn't be bothered. Now, my dear old father, who was a brilliant man, if he was trying to explain someone something, they came to him and asked him, and he started laying it out for them, A, B, C, and they started to disagree with him. He'd say to them, listen, I'm not licensed to teach kindergarten. I can't help you. And then he would not say any more. They couldn't get any more out of him. So, clarity is important. In any teaching, and I consider myself a plain man and I try to speak plainly, and in any teaching, in any preaching, the bottom line goal is make it plain. Because if people leave the assembly confused, you didn't do a good job. If people leave the assembly more confused than when they entered, you did a terrible job. Make it plain. If our volunteer song leaders will come up, we'll have our closing song, hymn number 378, Only One Life.
I'd ask y'all to stand.
To praise thee and of thy
several days, so we expect to be here unless there's a blizzard and see what Jonah is up to. And in the meantime, in this upcoming week, get out there and chase that love. Pursue it. And see if you can apprehend that for which you were apprehended. A benediction today is from Colossians. Let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. And whatever you do, in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Amen.